having the, because, you know, we're so much about evidence and what's your, you know, what's the proof, that I'm really glad that I have these visual and audio pieces of evidence to share.
We're always on Radio Survivor trying to broaden our understanding of what radio is and what radio history is. So, Monica De La Torre, I'm so thankful that you came on the show to tell us more about KDNA and this important history. So thanks again.
Thank you all so much. I'm such a fan. And I just, I'm really thankful that that you create the space and continue to broadcast in this medium, because...
Elevator going up! This is Jerry Only of the Misfits. You're listening to WGXC 90.
Acre
7 Hudson.
I'm Cheryl Kay, host of the Jazz Disturbance on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. The Jazz Disturbance features jazz and other improvised music. Tune in on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on 90.7 FM, wavefarm.org/listen, tune in, and on the Wave Farm Radio app on your smartphone. Playlists are posted at facebook.com/CKDisturbance.
Hi, Laura Kuhn here, director of the John Cage Trust, bringing you a deep dive into the intriguing life and work of Renaissance man John Cage, celebrated composer, poet, philosopher, chess pupil of Marcel Duchamp, life partner of Merce Cunningham, macrobiotic chef, exponent of Zen, visual artist, and avid and pioneering mycologist. Tune in to All Things Cage, 7 p.m. Saturdays beginning January 2nd, for conversations with cage experts and enthusiasts from around the world, right here at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears, and via the web at wavefarm.org.
Now, from Survival comes an economical do-it-yourself fallout shelter.
Civil defense approved and easy to assemble. Takes just a weekend.
Get maximum protection from nuclear fallout for your family.
See a Survival shelter today.
Wave Farm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Karen Werner of Montague, Massachusetts. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You are listening to Transmission Arts Programming on WGXC. 90.7 FM.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Brendan J. Lyons reports in the Times Union that a video shows Catskill police officers ran and hid instead of helping 29-year-old Jason Jones after they tasered him and he burst into flames. Jones later died after an extended stay in the burn unit of a Syracuse hospital. The video shows two Catskill police officers running out of their station lobby after he burst into flames, and another who, instead of helping, stood, and I quote, around the corner of an interior wall rather than rush to the aid of the man who was burning in front of him, end quote. Instead of the police helping the man who needed medical attention, a civilian who witnessed the scene through a window can be seen on the video entering the station and trying to console Jones by hugging him. Jones was a well-known athlete at Catskill High School a decade ago, and just after midnight, October 31st, he walked into the Village of Catskill Police Station on Main Street and doused himself with hand sanitizer. The video does not show Jones attacking police, but one of the officers fires a taser at him, and his head catches fire immediately. Then, just as quick, the three officers disappear from the video. Kevin A. LeBrand, an attorney representing Jones' family, said in response to the release of the video, and I quote, Jason was unarmed, in the police station, and not threatening anyone when the police hit him with 50,000 volts of electrical current and he ignited. Instead of helping Jason, the police ran out of the room, shut the door, and let him burn, end quote. The Times Union quotes an anonymous police official who is not involved in the case, said that his officers are trained to never use a taser on an individual who may have been recently exposed to a flammable liquid, including hand sanitizer, which contains alcohol. He also said officers should have helped the man immediately. The official said, and I quote, once the threat had been stopped, you don't just say, I'm going to let that person burn, end quote. The State Attorney General's Office of Special Investigation has taken over the case from Greene County District Attorney Joseph Stanzoni because of a 2015 executive order empowering the Attorney General to investigate fatal encounters between police and unarmed civilians. Jones died last month after spending 48 days on a ventilator in an intensive care unit at Upstate University Hospital in Syracuse. The investigation is continuing, and the Attorney General's office said in a statement, and I quote, the release of this footage is not an expression of any opinion as to the guilt or innocence of any party in a criminal matter or any opinion as to how or whether any individual may be charged with a crime, end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. On January 4th, Hunter Tannersville Schools announced that so many staff had called in sick with COVID-19 that school was going virtual all week. On January 6th, Catskill Schools made similar announcements, staying closed through the MLK holiday next week. In Dutchess County, the Dover School District, the Millbrook District, Pauling Elementary School, and the Arlington District were also closed at least some of the past week because of staff shortages from coronavirus. Nick Reisman at New York State of Politics reports that on January 6th, the association that represents state Supreme Court justices in New York said it wants court proceedings to go virtual again because of the sharp rise in COVID-19 cases this month. Queen State Supreme Court Justice Carmen Velasquez, the president of the Association of Supreme Court Justices, said, and I quote, "I am fully vaccinated and am quarantining at home with symptoms. I am extremely concerned about the health of our justices and court employees and the health of those who come into our courthouses. That must be our paramount consideration," end quote. Most local counties are now reporting a record number of new COVID-19 cases, with rising hospitalizations and deaths. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. David Robinson reports in the Poughkeepsie Journal that on January 7th, Governor Kathy Hochul mandated a COVID-19 booster shot for healthcare workers in the state because of the rising numbers of vaccine breakthrough infections caused by the Omicron variant. A state health department panel must approve the mandate on January 11th. If they do, Hochul said, workers at hospitals, nursing homes, and other healthcare settings need to get the booster shot within 2 weeks of becoming eligible. New York implemented one of the nation's first vaccine mandates for healthcare workers on September 27th. Hochul said, and I quote, "We're asking them to do the right thing once more," end quote. The state hospitals are struggling with nearly 11,600 hospitalizations January 6th from COVID-19. As of January 4th, 22% of the 94,000 direct care workers in New York nursing homes have gotten a booster shot, while 35% of fully vaccinated Americans have taken a booster shot. And you can read more about this story in the Poughkeepsie Journal. And that wraps up the WGXE News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, community information, or COVID-19 updates, visit our website at WGXE.org. From the WGXE Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
A new law on the books in New York establishes the most comprehensive drinking water testing and notification program in the nation for PFAS, the substances also known as forever chemicals. Rob Hayes with Environmental Advocates New York says every water utility across the state will have to test for the nearly 24 toxic chemicals on the state's first list of emerging contaminants. He says notifications will be sent to the public if unsafe levels are detected in drinking water.
New Yorkers are about to finally find out what's in their water and if they're being exposed to toxic PFAS chemicals. We're going to see testing hopefully starting this year, and then there will be regular testing happening for new contaminants every so often after that.
High exposure to PFAS chemicals has been found to negatively affect human health and the environment. Backers of the new law are urging the State Department of Health to set notification levels for low amounts of every emerging contaminant listed. Clean water advocacy groups have been pushing for transparency about toxic chemicals for more than 4 years. Manna Jo Green of Hudson River Sloop Clearwater says the legislation ties in with the new Green Amendment voters overwhelmingly passed on the November ballot.
It's an actual amendment to the New York State Constitution that guarantees the right to clean air, clean water, and a healthy environment. This is a specific way to implement and ensure those rights.
In recent years, New York has enacted several bills to eliminate the use of PFAS chemicals in products like firefighting foam and food packaging. Hayes hopes to see even more efforts to ban them in other products.
Because really, if we want to prevent water contamination, we have to stop these chemicals at the source. When we put them into products, they end up in our environment and they put public health at risk.
He notes a second list that includes 14 more chemicals as emerging contaminants will be published in coming years. Under the law, the New York Department of Health must update the list of emerging contaminants at least every 3 years. I'm Michaela Savitt for New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC weekend COVID-19 update. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about this story. This weekend, local new COVID-19 case counts are at record numbers, with deaths increasing. In Columbia County, there were 172 more cases announced January 6th and 188 more and another death announced January 7th. In Greene County, officials reported 215 more cases and one more death on January 6th and 108 more cases on January 7th. Meanwhile, in Ulster County, officials reported a surge in COVID-19 cases with 509 more cases than the day before and a total above 4,400 for the first time since the pandemic began in March 2020. Ulster County also reported 2 more deaths on January 7th. Dutchess County, on the other hand, had a decline in both coronavirus cases and hospitalizations. But Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro said the dip in numbers there is, quote, not a trend. We do expect cases to continue to grow, unquote, Molinaro said. Quote, we might experience a bit of a break, not much, before we experience cases associated with New Year's Eve celebrations and interactions, unquote. Molinaro said hospitalizations in Dutchess County are still at, quote, a number that is obviously of concern and is putting stress on the hospital systems throughout the Hudson Valley, unquote. And many of those cases are young people. 19% of the cases in Dutchess County are among 20 to 29-year-olds, with 17% between 30 and 39 years old. And in Albany County, officials announced another death January 7th, a resident in his 90s. Albany County officials also announced 939 new positive cases. That is a giant number, but a slight decrease from the record high of 1,010 reported on January 6th. Also, the number of hospitalized coronavirus patients in Albany County has doubled since Christmas, with 102 county residents in a hospital January 7th with coronavirus and 16 patients in intensive care. Quote, unfortunately, the number of our residents in ICUs with the virus is trending up as well, now at the highest level since February 12th, unquote, said Albany County Executive Dan McCoy. Read more about this story in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
And now here is your WGXC weather update. Your forecast for the weekend. Well, on Saturday, sunny with a high near 28 degrees. Saturday night, partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 20 degrees. And on Sunday, freezing rain before 1 p.m., then rain, snow, and sleet likely between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m., then rain and snow is likely after 4 p.m. The temperature high will be 35 degrees. And on Sunday night, a chance of snow showers mainly after 1 a.m. It will be mostly cloudy with a temperature low of around 21 degrees. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Nora E. Edelman of Athens, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about Creative Community Radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Wave Farm, based in Acre, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune in to transmission art and experimental sound programming overnight and on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC.
hands-on, listener-supported radio for Greene and Columbia counties. We'll be right back.
radio. Gregory Whitehead, radio artist, calls Captain Ahab of Moby Dick fame the first shock jock, as the scarred and hobbled lightning-struck captain rants his way through the pages of Moby Dick. Waving his harpoon at the stormy skies, filled with hate for the elusive whale, Ahab is struck by lightning, electrified, his peg leg tapping out a Morse code of vengeance across the deck. Ahab may be a forerunner to the big-mouthed, blasted broadcast radio hosts, who we will not name at this moment, but we can imagine who they are. But what of other pelagic metaphors to be found in this story? For instance, what of the great white whale? The interaction of human with whale in Moby Dick was not one of empathy or mercy, but one of mass slaughter. However, perverse moments of transcendence seem to have taken place on the human side of this most violent communication. The character of Ishmael narrates a famous and particularly tactile episode which takes place when he has been flensing the whales caught on the boat, an encounter with spermaceti, or the material inside the spermaceti organ, which is on the big melon head of sperm whales. And it enables echolocation and sound making in a sperm whale. So it's a gigantic organ filled with the spermaceti material. When flensing and rendering whales into oil upon the whaling ships, whalers had to squeeze the lumps out of the spermaceti, which Ishmael describes as a sweet and unctuous duty, enabling fellowship in close proximity. I will read this little famous passage. I squeezed that sperm till a strange sort of insanity overcame me, and I found myself unwittingly squeezing my co-laborers' hands in it, mistaking their hands for the gentle globules. Such an abounding, affectionate, friendly, loving feeling did this avocation beget, that I at last was continually squeezing their hands and looking up into their eyes sentimentally, as if to say, oh, my dear fellow beings, why should we longer cherish any social acerbities or know the slightest ill humor or envy? Come, let us squeeze hands all round. Nay, let us squeeze ourselves into each other. Let us squeeze ourselves universally into the very milk and sperm of kindness. So here the whale spermaceti, the actual stuff which allows sperm whales to echolocate and communicate, becomes a medium for human communication. Sadly, Ishmael's profound encounter with humans happens through the body of this slaughtered whale. But what if the whale proposed an alternate understanding of transmission in its own society that is entirely missing from this account? So recent studies of toothed whales and dolphins, let's see if I've got a little whale here, there we go. Toothed whales and dolphins, also known as odontocetes, pretty much all of the current whale research now discusses whales as having culture, as living in societies, as speaking languages and dialects. The brains of humpback whales, dolphins, orcas, sperm whales, and others are especially developed in areas of acoustic processing and communication intelligence. And researchers have been able to observe that they use very complex language, including very distinct dialects among different groups, even living in close proximity to one another. That they pass memories and knowledge on to subsequent generations through communal recollection, that they have self-consciousness, pardon me, complex coalition formation skills, and have been known to use tools. Sound travels more than four times more quickly in water than in air, and water is a particularly excellent medium for long-range transmission of low-frequency sounds. As a result, the use of echolocation and acoustic communication among whales and dolphins holds some surprising parallels to the notions of resonant transmission that I've been discussing with regard to radio. Sperm whale researchers describe being in the water near a group of sperms and feeling the pulses in their bones as they are echolocated from close range by the whales. And so too, dolphin researchers, such as Kathleen Dudzinski and Tony Frohoff, they write, when a dolphin turns toward you and explores you acoustically with echolocation, you may even feel the buzz of sound waves in your bones and muscles as you reveal more detailed aspects of your physiology to the dolphin by sound waves, more information than the eyes can see. Kind of like a little ultrasound, almost. These researchers speculate that such intimacy among whales enable the tight social formations and more extensive group consciousness that cetaceans exhibit, while long-range echolocation and sound making allows whales to have an acute spatial sense in their surroundings. Thus, whales would seem to use sonic communications in ways that are physically, socially, and geographically resonant. says Peter Hoare, it was as if they were resounding miles below, even as they radioed their presence to other whales miles apart. Tuned into some unseen circuit of food and communal intent, they knew instinctively where they were, while we wonder constantly what on earth we are doing. That's regarding sperm whales hunting 2 miles below and making little echolocational sounds. Listening in on hydrophones, researcher Hal Whitehead notes that sperm whales grazing deep underwater keep a constant chorus of clicks. The jumble of clicks of a group of hunting sperms, which together sound like radio static. Sperms also produce recognizable codas, which Whitehead and others understand as signature sounds, dialects, or possibly musical elements involved in whale communication. Orcas, or killer whales, also use backscatter effects from echolocation to distinguish and hunt their favorite Chinook salmon among a school of other salmon. And spinner dolphins communally forage for and trap fish utilizing collective phonation, an ability by a group to sonically navigate as well as converse in low visibility waters with broadband clicks and focus bursts of sound. So really illuminating the landscape of the ocean as a group. In an even stronger and perhaps stranger radiophonic parallel, recent research by a dentist, actually, Martin Nguia, into the nature of narwhal tusks reveals that, the narwhal is this northern sort of small cetacean whale, where for a long time they thought that it was a horn coming out of the forehead of the narwhal, kind of like the unicorn whale, but in fact turns out that the tusk is a tooth that pierces, that grows through the lip, pierces the lip, and grows to be approximately 5 feet long. And they're mainly in the male whales, but some female whales grow these tusks as well. Anyway, for a while there was this idea that the tusk was a jousting tool, the males competing for the females, jousting in the northern seas. Well, of course, it turns out to be nonsense. That, in fact, the tusk is more like an antenna, surprisingly. Unlike other teeth, its surface has open tubules connected to inner nerves. It is, in effect, a giant sense organ, basically a tooth turned inside out with the sensitive part on the outside and the solid, strong part on the inside. It's lined with 10 million nerve endings to enable the animal to detect subtle changes in temperature and pressure. This may explain why narwhals raise their tusks above water as if to sniff the air. Other research indicates that the tusk is not only a sensory probe, but may also be a transmitter or receiver of sound and even of electricity. The narwhal tusk turns out to be, as I said, a tooth turned inside out, with all its sensitive sensing faculties at the surface and the hardest mineralized dentin deposits at the center, producing a spiraling tooth that is strong and flexible, if still mysterious. So whale radio? Are we talking about whale radio? It would seem to be a form of wireless which is both intimate and tactile, and promiscuous at long range. Entirely resonant, requiring the feedback loop of resounding to be meaningful, and requiring everyone in the circuit to both send and receive. Of course, whale radio relies on mechanical, not electromagnetic waves, but remains a really potent example. Could humans develop such capacities in such social life? Or could the example of whale radio temper the ethics of the technologies that we do develop in order to communicate at a distance? Can it challenge what we think communication is for, how long it takes, and what forms it takes?
Now to absorb some local color through the magic of AM radio.
The book of Revelations tells us to watch for the 7 signs of evil.
Bacon, sign of evil number 4.
Continuing our sign of evil countdown, here's Vanessa Williams.
So when that old man told me when I was a kid, and I'm like, how do radios work? And he's like, you know what? There's these transistors and these things and all that. And I'm like, what was that? And he goes, you know what, kid? It's magic.
You know what?
It's just magic.
It's not magic.
Have you? I don't know if we talked about this before, but like in the 1890s, on giant farms out west and even some around here, in order to get information from one side of the farm to the other, some cowboys and others and farmers would set up telephone systems on their barbed wire. Have you heard about this?
Telephone systems on the barbed wire?
Why not? Sounds awesome.
I know. Well, they do things like if you have like say a 100,000 acre ranch in Texas, and there's a prairie fire, you got to tell somebody, and it's gonna be too late for writing it. They hook up a phone to the barbed wire, and they have a really scratchy transmission back to the barn or house, and
that's kind of cool,
right?
Yeah. Nice.
Anyway. and you don't have to pay a phone company any money.
That's right.
Well, that's why we're working on the CB aspect here. We want our own network. We want...
But I've also got another antenna on the way. It's a dual band 70 centimeter and 2 meter antenna. So it's got like some collinear elements with coils, inductors between the each radiating element.
Okay,
you can get it for like $70 at Home Depot.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you have to have it shipped to the store. I don't know where it's coming from. But
China.
Send me a link. I'll check it out.
Okay.
Because I'm mostly trying to do my own homemade antennas.
Yeah.
Just for the fun of it, because why not? Everybody's got like wire and garbage hanging around. If you could do something simple with something lying around, why not? And
not everybody has that skill, right?
Well, we have the ability to simplify processes. So yeah. Why not do it 1,000 different ways, figure out the best one, and then the best way to do it, and then go, hey guys, do you want to send free like text messages to the people in the next town? We figured out how. Pretty close.
In the least janky way possible?
It's going to take nodes.
Yep.
But they're going to be independent, easy blocks you could just put somewhere in someone's like backyard. They'll never know it's there. It'll look like a rock.
Never know it's there.
Node of rocks and trees.
Well, think about it. If we could use one of the long-range propagation methods for digital communication, even effectively at a long range, slowly, you could send significant messages, even if you have, as long as you have a send and forward capability, a send, store, and forward capability.
Store and forwarding.
I think of everything like a satellite now because I like playing with satellites.
Yeah, a nodal model. Yeah.
You can have a node like, oh, we can't quite reach the next town. So we're going to take a node, we're going to put it on the edge of our town, and we're going to have a little Yagi clip to the top of this one and point it that way. Now we have a connection to the next town. That town is going to have one little Yagi.
Two Yagis. One for send, one for receive.
One direction, the other direction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why can't you use the same antenna for both?
Because you remember that Moxon antenna that I showed you?
Yeah.
The one that's like a simplified folded dipole slash Yagi mix.
You have to time domain split it somehow accurately.
Did you look at the did I send you the modeling chart for that?
I'm not sure.
No? Or the simulation of it?
Assume that the listeners at home don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Okay, so it's basically shaped like a square and it's fed on one of the sides of the square.
Okay.
And that driven side is, so that's where the coaxial and the coaxial feed is attached. And that side will be the direction that the big gain is on. And on the other side, the reflector side, it's reflecting all of that electrical energy back towards that.
Yes.
Fed side.
Which is why it should work just fine for transmission and reception.
There's actually a big null. There's actually a big null to the back of it. So that's why you can't use a Yagi for two opposing directions.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean. What you mean is the Yagi has to be pointed at the other town so that you can send receive to the other town, but that node is also going to have to send data into the town that it's a part of.
Correct.
And that's going to need another antenna.
You don't have to worry about that.
That antenna is going to clip onto the top, and that one's going to be a vertical because that's going to be able to reach one of the other nodes in that town. And the local nodes will have small vertical antennas. Yeah. They'll be easily hidden. They'll be self-sufficient with little, like, solar panels. And they're just going to bounce digital signals over the frequencies that it's capable of.
That's its local network, yeah.
And this system's going to be very easily overloaded by people. So it's going to have to follow a lot of methods that have already been figured out by the ham network.
It's all in software, sir.
Yep.
You got to parse it and stop the...
Oh, yeah. We're going to have to make smart boxes to handle things.
The various ways you can actually accidentally DDoS yourselves by overloading and losing packets. And
For something like wide area AT&T free, that's what you need.
Yeah.
There's no other way around it. We're not going to do this bouncing off the ionosphere. We can't count on meteor scanner. We can't count on auroras. We can't count on ground waves.
You can't count on network time protocol.
Yes, you can.
Oh, yes, you can.
What?
Except when you can.
You gotta try something.
You got a job at the radio station?
Oh, great, that place. It's dark and dirty and has, like, what, those three weirdos who work there?
We'll be right back. for some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
Thank you.